Россия как была, так и остается главным и откровенно. Мы суверенные, независимые.
Мы с Россией не чужие друг другу.
Партнеров ожидаем уважительного отношения.
Это не значит,
лишь, что мы россияне. Мы белорусы и
русская
россияне.
Кровь перемешанная с белорусской и польской.
Мы ваши братья. Мы всегда были вместе.
У нас может.
You can call it the Lukashenko shuffle, and the authoritarian Belarusian leader has been doing it for years. Play the loyal Moscow ally until you need something, like lower gas prices, for example. Then cozy up to the West and blackmail your Kremlin patrons. Everybody knew what he was doing, and everybody played along with this little two-step. But something has changed in the wake of the Ukraine crisis. Alexander Lukashenko's criticism of Moscow has become more persistent and more pronounced, and his overtures to the West appear more serious and more sincere. Suddenly, Lukashenko's little dance has become a lot more consequential and a lot more dangerous. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is Alexei Snatkevich of RFRL's Belarus service. Welcome to the podcast, Alexei.
Hello.
And also joining us on the Skype line from Kyiv is Andrew Wilson, a senior policy fellow at the European Council of Foreign Relations and author of the book Belarus, the Last European Dictatorship, and the recently published Ukraine Crisis, What It Means for the West. Welcome aboard, Andrew.
Hi.
Well, since the Ukraine conflict broke out last year, Lukashenko seems to be going out of his way to antagonize Russia. He slammed Russia's justification for annexing Crimea, saying Mongolia could easily use the same excuse to annex large swaths of Russia. He's backed legislation that defines the appearance in Belarus of the so-called Little Green Men as an act of war. And he was caught on an open mic agreeing with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, saying that Vladimir Putin was playing a, quote, dirty game. Lukashenko's also turned Minsk into a neutral venue for negotiations between Moscow and the West over the Ukraine crisis. He's indicated that he would like to attend the EU's Eastern Partnership Summit in Riga, and there is speculation that the EU may actually invite him. Alexei, from our discussions off mic, we've been talking about this quite a bit over the last few weeks. I know you're skeptical about all of this. What's your take? What's Lukashenko's game?
First of all, all these things are taken out of context because yesterday there was a Lukashenko address to the parliament and to the nation, and we made a comparison of how the Russian media covered it and how the Ukrainian media covered it, and we put together 10 lines from the Russian media, 10 headlines, and 10 Ukrainian headlines. And I have it in Russian here. I'll translate some of it, like Russian media. Lukashenko, Belarus has always been and will be with Russia. Number two, Lukashenko thinks Russia is its main partner, but he hopes to improve the relations with the United States. Lukashenko, Belarus has always been and will be shoulder to shoulder with Russia. Okay, we look at the Ukrainian media. Number one, Lukashenko, Belarus will not live by the directions of Moscow. Number two, Lukashenko is ready to arm 500,000 Belarusians in case the situation deteriorates. Lukashenko takes back his words about the role of Belarus in the Russian world. Okay? So everybody takes, you said sincere and Lukashenko. For me, it's an oxymoron. So these things that have been quoted in the Western media were spoken for the Western media and are taken out of the context of his pro-Russian rhetorics and, more importantly, of his corridor of his opportunities. He's not able to become a pro-Western politician.
I don't think he can either, and I want to get into that a little bit later. But he's doing some things, and you're right. You can take a lot of this out of context. His speech yesterday was, I thought, a textbook case of the Lukashenko shuffle. I mean, he was really having it both ways in that speech. But there's some things you don't take out of context. When he went to Tbilisi, for example, and made the comment how, I love visiting Georgia, and the last time I was in Georgia, I was in Suhumi, and it was great. I mean, when he's basically saying the capital of separatist Abkhazia is part of recognizing what the rest of the world recognizes, but what Russia certainly doesn't recognize. He seems to be twisting the knife. When he said that Mongolia could use the same argument to annex swaths of Russia, that Russia used to annex Crimea. He's never recognized Abkhazia, South Ossetia. Back in the 90s...
And he has a reason for that. I mean, it hasn't changed compared to 2008. When I was listening to his address yesterday, it reminded me of one more politician who has lower status in the world ranks, Mr. Kadyrov. When he speaks, he says he wants to control his territory, he wants to control Chechnya. And you remember he said recently that if federal security agents come, we should shoot them. Mm-hmm. Lukashenko, on the other hand, has this status of internationally recognized leader. And he understands that as soon as he recognizes something like Abkhazia or South Ossetia, which they were pushing him in the year 2008, as soon as he recognizes them, he lowers himself to their level. So he has his reasons not to do this, even before the Ukrainian conflict. Mm,
so, and these reasons have nothing to do with antagonizing Moscow or showing independence from Moscow?
He wants to show some independence, and of course, but he does not have the opportunity and he doesn't have the ability to become, you know, truly independent. He has his limits. He has his red lines. He can go to Georgia, but he won't go to Riga.
I'm very curious whether he goes to Riga, quite frankly. Andrew, let's bring Andrew Wilson into the discussion here. Andrew, what do you think? Has something changed since the Ukraine crisis with Lukashenko?
I'm skeptical, but I also think that stuff has changed. I mean, giving out different signals to different audiences is part of the game of balance. But we have to look a bit more closely at what type of game of balance it is. He's not standing in the middle of a plank, you know, in a literal sense of balance. He has to be closer to Russia because Russia pays him. You know, Russia keeps the Belarusian economy afloat, and Russia supports the political system that he has. But recent, attacks on Ukraine have threatened that. What's in question here is Belarusian sovereignty. Little Green Men you mentioned, joint exercises on Belarusian territory, the kind of influence of Russian language media in Belarus. You know, there are many levers that Russia can pull that Lukashenko doesn't want to see them pulling. So what he wants to be is more secure, you know, in his own safe little home, keep the money flowing, keep the political system intact. And he needs to kind of spread his bets to persuade us to help him do that.
And do you see the West helping him do that? What's in it for the West here? Because Alexei's right. Lukashenko could never be a Western ally by virtue of the fact that he's an authoritarian dictator.
Not by the virtue that he is an authoritarian dictator, but the virtue, Andrew said it correctly, that he is subsidized by Russia, he is dependent on Russia, and as soon as he tries to cozy up to West, he will lose that, and it's more important for him to keep that than anything that West can give him, or at least anything that West has promised to give him so far.
Andrew, what's in it for the West?
Well, the West has to get its analysis right, first and foremost. He's not liberalizing or anything like that.
By any stretch of the imagination.
No. There were some illusions that he was.
Back in 2010.
Yeah, last time we had a kind of similar rapprochement back in 2010, briefly. So we have to be clear about what he's doing. We have to be clear about what we want. Is it geopolitically useful to us to kind of secure Ukraine's northern flank? You know, maybe it is. Obviously, Russian troops on Belarusian territory threatening Kiev directly or whatever. Now, that's something that we wouldn't want. Are we prepared to pay for that? Are we interested in playing our own version of divide and rule? Russia's very good at that. Is it good to see that Belarus is a very reluctant member of the Eurasian Economic Union, for example? Does that serve our interest? Is this about protecting Ukraine, or is it about trying to sort of tease Belarus a little bit into an outer orbit, you know, somewhere like Mercury rather than, you know, second planet closest to the sun?
No, I mean, I think you mentioned, I mean, we don't want Russian troops in Belarusian territory threatening Ukraine. Do you think that's really in terms of tangible things, is that the best we can hope for here, is that there won't be Russian troops on Belarusian territory threatening Ukraine, or can we get a little bit more?
Well, it's the minimum, because you've got a Western flank here as well. If you want to threaten the Baltic states seriously, you need Belarus.
Mm-hmm.
that's the potential second front that many people worry about.
So from the West, this is about keeping Belarus out of it, sort of. So they're not a staging ground.
At the very least.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are other wins that are possible.
Uh-huh.
I don't know about Minsk being a neutral venue for negotiations. I wouldn't perhaps go that far. that was clearly a useful part of the recent process, you know, however bad the Minsk agreements may be. But literally, I mean, if you look at Zapad exercises, where were they, 209, 218, they were literally about punching a land corridor to the Baltic states, you know, to prevent them attacking Moscow, I think it was. I can't remember which way around it was. And, you know, the Baltic states feel threatened enough already. So, you know, a little bit more security is good.
Right. So it's a lot of it is keeping them. I've been playing a lot lately with kind of historical analogies, basically, because like Lukashenko, maybe he'd like to be Tito, you know, when Tito was able to create his little independent fiefdom away from the Soviet Union while remaining a communist state. Or maybe Lukashenko's trying to be Ceausescu, which is, you know, the Romanian leader was able to play with the West, play with China, stay in the Warsaw Pact and kind of balance it all and keep a measure of independence for himself. Or maybe Lukashenko is going to end up like Dubček, the ill-fated Czechoslovak leader during the spring. What do you both weigh in here? What do you think? Do you see any of these as likely, or would you throw something else in there? Because I think I often like to do this, to bring in historical and other analogies that
Well, Ceausescu is closest. I mean, he's not going to become a Dubček-type reformer who will be, you know, taken by the Russian paratroopers because he wants to start, you know, Belarusian model with human face. That's not something that will happen. Ceausescu is a close model in the sense that he is an authoritarian ruler who is in a military union. I mean, when you say Russian troops won't come to Belarus territory, they are already there. And there's an agreement which was made after the Ukrainian situation. Despite all those statements by Lukashenko, there'll be more Russian bombers in Babruysk probably next year. And Babruysk is quite close to the Ukrainian border. I mean, theoretically, these bombers can go and bomb Ukrainian territory in case something like serious happens. And what we're talking about is, of course, his political will. And he also understands that if he allows such thing to happen, again, he loses his status as an independent leader. So Ceausescu was the only one who did not give his troops to invade Czechoslovakia. Yeah. And Lukashenko certainly wants to follow this model in the sense that he doesn't want to be seen as a Russian puppet.
Mm. Andrew, your thoughts?
Yeah, of the three, Ceausescu is certainly the closest, although not a perfect fit. Sure, there's Russian troops already. We know that. The subtext.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you to follow up on that a little. Actually.
Yeah, was Lukashenko giving a cold shoulder to the idea of joint exercises on Belarusian territory this spring? Tito is interesting because, you know, he was still in the socialist camp, remember?
Yeah.
So he wasn't, again, he wasn't equidistant, he wasn't in the middle. But on the other hand, he led the non-aligned movement, you know, which was genuinely in the middle, or at least wanted to be. Lukashenko doesn't play that kind of game. One interesting parallel, though, is that I once heard a Moscow guy, a Kremlin guy, complain about collective Titoism, which was his term of abuse for all the kind of other post-Soviet leaders, by which he meant that, like Tito and Stalin, he wasn't doing what he was told. So in that kind of analogy sense, Tito is, you know, possibly relevant. Also, you know, Tito was kind of more socialist than thou. You know, his model of socialism was better than the Soviet Union's, and you sometimes get that with Lukashenko, that, you know, Belarus is more Slavic, you know, more orthodox, more whatever, you know,
and more stable, and more. I mean, there's greater social
welfare. And more Russian than the Russians.
Yeah, better Russians than the Russians.
How so?
Well, he was saying that the Belarusians are Russians, but the Russians with the quality of the first quality, like the highest of the highest order, yeah. Like Russians in Russia are not as Russian as Belarusians.
Now, there's another thing that Lukashenko's been doing. I didn't touch on it in my opening remarks, but he's suddenly become a champion of the Belarusian language.
No.
Or at least is pretending to be.
No, again, it's couple of quotes verbally. taken out of the context. And I mean, when somebody says that he has become a champion of the Belarusian language, it means that he said in some public address or in some, that we shouldn't forget our nice Belarusian language. And he said it probably in Russian mostly.
I'm sure he said it in Russian. But he also said there's also, correct me if I'm wrong, there's legislation pending or may have been passed to have certain classes in schools taught in Belarusian, which would be revolutionary under Lukashenko.
Well, it should be some of the steps back. Like these classes have been, I mean, all the educational system has been Russified under Lukashenko. So he's basically has taken about 70, 80 steps for Russification, and now he's making two or three steps back, okay? So if we look at the context of Belarus itself. Now, what he is doing, in which it might be important, is these public statements probably change the perception of Belarusian language by the bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends, he told me that his friends also, acquaintances who deal with civic initiatives, Belarusian culture, Belarusian language, they now, when they talk to government officials, those officials are more friendly towards them, but those officials do not know what to do. Because they have not been given any specific orders what to do with these civic initiatives. Mm. They only have heard on TV or maybe in some government meeting that you shouldn't press the Belarusian language, we should support Belarusian language. So now they have mixed signals. So it might become a positive factor in the sense that the grassroots movements, the grassroots initiatives will not be suppressed as they have been before.
Why do you think that is? What do you think the purpose of that is?
Well, Lukashenko probably has understood that he's gone too far in this eradication of national identity. It was a very important part of his game. First of all, by doing this, he was destroying his political enemies, but on the other hand, he was taken by Russia as part of the family. You know, Russians, when they are coming to Belarus, they feel that they are in another Russian state. They don't feel abroad. They feel that the country is different because they say, we've come to Europe. The streets are cleaner, the architecture is European, but everybody speaks Russian, the Russian signs, the Russian... Actually, that was an important thing in his yesterday's address. He was basically saying sorry to some Russian publicists on some marginal sites who were criticizing Belarus for introducing Belarusian language signs somewhere in Vitebsk region. And he was saying basically things like, but we have our Belarusian language and it was under Masharov in the Soviet times. It was under Stalin even. Mm-hmm. So we're not doing anything new. We are just keeping our Belarusian language. But basically, he was not speaking as a head of an independent state. He was more speaking like a head of a region in the Soviet Union in this sense.
Andrew, what do you make of the shift in the language? Or is there a shift?
Yeah, champion. Is going champion. Too far.
I always go too far. That's what I do. It's provocative.
Yeah, but Lukashenko clearly has a sense that he's built a strong state, but not a strong nation to go with it. For several years now, you've had this slogan, Za Belarus, for Belarus.
No, actually, Za Belarus, it's 2001 already.
Like, yeah.
14 years.
Yeah, but it's pretty empty, you know, why? What's the content of the slogan? So that needs a bit of work. And it's also related to this point about mass media, that he's not going to switch everything to Belarusian overnight. But the fact that, according to some figures, two-thirds of Belarusians tune into and mainly prefer Russian mass media is a point of weakness, which basically comes down to whose propaganda are you listening to? And he'd much rather Belarusians were listening to his rather than Putin's.
So you think maybe the end of this is for him to get control of the propaganda that Belarusians listen to, and he's going to start doing this in the Belarusian language?
Yeah. I mean, we're not talking about democratization here. That was our unit.
Here we shouldn't mix two things, Belarusian language and the propaganda, because most of the Belarusian propaganda is already in Russian language. And most of the Belarusians are listening to Belarusian TV as well in the Russian language. The problem is that the Russian TV channels are of higher quality. And in the past, there were several occasions when Lukashenko ordered to switch off Russian television when they were showing some you know, Godfather 1, Godfather 2 movies. So, but it's very important for him to build his own propaganda, which would be competitive with the Russian, but it, we shouldn't mix two things, like building a national identity through language and building this propaganda machine, because, I mean, most of the Belarusian propaganda is still in Russian.
And what about that? Would he be able to compete with the Russian? Because at the end of the day, even if he does this, the Russian TV is much higher quality, much better financed, much slicker. We've had whole conferences on how slick Russian television is, and hearings in Congress on how effective it is as an international weapon. Do you think this is viable even for him to get control of the propaganda this way?
Well, one thing that we shouldn't say or assume is that Lukashenko is a genius and he gets everything right.
But he's showing himself to be very crafty, a lot craftier than I thought he was.
But, you know, I mean, he's basically right, but Belarusian national identity is weak, as we all know. It's sort of Russia-light, but there are elements of distinction, so it's about trying to create more of that very late in the day. And if it comes to a crisis, you know, the media is a point of weakness. Also, in terms of little green men, which you mentioned at the top, sure, you know, he's passed a law, but if you look at the state of the Belarusian armed forces or whatever, you know, they couldn't exactly, you know, stop them.
Right.
So it's a balancing act, but it's also a kind of conjuring trick to try and, you know, make himself look more powerful and more independent than he actually is.
Now, you mentioned he's built a strong state, but has not built a strong nation. That seemed almost to be by design. And now, why change that now?
Well, for his first 10 years at least, his priority was to destroy his old opponents, which was the, you know, Belarusian National Front and related organizations. And in some ways, he did that too effectively. And then from about 2003, he started sort of picking up some of the pieces, you know, in terms of history or language. So this kind of eclectic magpie approach to nation building has actually been going on for slightly longer than just the last year or so. But, yeah, in some ways it's his own fault. You know, he hollowed out the system.
And this benefits him now to build up the nation, though?
Well, he thinks the nation is him. You know, let's have them one. But, you know, people need a little bit more of that if they're going to sort of bequeath, you know, a nation after they disappear from the scene.
One more thing I wanted to touch on before we moved on to the second segment is Lukashenko's speech yesterday to Parliament. Did he not seem a little bit off to you? I mean, I've talked to some of your colleagues in the Belarusian service earlier in the day about this. Jan Maksymiuk in particular said he just seemed ill-prepared. He's usually very well-prepared for these things, and he was just a little off.
He was unfocused in the sense that, the main theme, I think, was very, very well crafted. He started with the fact that Belarus is an island of stability in the sea of wars and problems. We don't have anything like in the neighboring Ukraine where bombs are falling. Then he said, but fortunately, we don't have these problems in the battlefields, and we don't have these problems in the squares, but we do have problems in the economy. And part of it, most of it, is to blame on the outside influences, the world economic crisis, the sanctions against Russia and the following slump of the Russian economy, the drop in the Russian ruble, the problems in the Russian markets. Mm-hmm. So, but we also are to blame ourselves for part of it. We don't do it properly in some topics. And then for... So this start was very, like, well-crafted. Right. But then he was going for 2.5 hours about these economic issues, dropping this, jumping from that to that,
yeah, he was,
from women to Jews to everything.
Yeah, he
made everything.
Some very bizarre comments about the Jewish community.
Just without any emphasis. Without any emphasis. Like, everything was important and nothing was important. So it was like
he not prepared? What was the problem?
I had an impression that the things that he would really like to say, the emphasis in economic policy, are the things that would not be pleasant for the people to hear. So he was talking about these things, but he didn't want to emphasize them. He didn't want to sound negative, and he didn't want to sound like, you know, Margaret Thatcher coming and saying things that we need to, you know, cut this and cut that, and we need to take care of ourselves. He was saying these things. I mean, he has regularly been saying very, you know, liberal market economy, laissez-faire things, dropping them for many years already. But he doesn't want to sound, he's balancing them with, you know, if he says that we need to allow to bankrupt some enterprise, next sentence will be, we also need to give these people jobs and keep that enterprise, producing different things.
This is a paradox he's stuck in, because in order to become independent from Russia truly, he does have to liberalize that economy. But if he liberalizes that economy, it's going to lead to a liberalization of the political system eventually, and it's going to threaten him. So he's really caught in a paradox. It's very similar to the paradox Russia's in. But he has to liberalize, but he can't liberalize politically. Andrew, what did you make of this?
Well, yeah, it's interesting that he focused on the economy, because the economy has two problems. One of them is cyclical, because the economy is state-owned and sort of subsidy-fed. It tends to go through the kind of Lukashenko version of boom and bust. You know, he pushes up wages, which leads to overconsumption, inflation, trade deficit, which bizarrely coincides with elections, like, you know, the election.
Maybe not so bizarrely.
Yeah, and we've got one this year. So there's that cyclical aspect, but there's also kind of longer-term secular problems. Exports to Russia are down because Russia's in recession, but also, you know, Belarusian manufacturers are kind of losing quality competition. In the longer run, foreign exchange reserves are minimal, under $5 billion, less than Ukraine's. And with oil and gas subsidies being, you know, Russia's still paying them, but they're not as generously as it used to. And that's already, you know, causing ripples throughout the rest of the economy. Traditionally, cheap energy is paid for the maintenance of some quite heavy industry. And there are a lot of layoffs in that sector now. So there's this combination of sort of double economic troubles, which is kind of worse than he's had before. And, you know, a dictator who writes his own speeches, probably that might be part of the problem, you know, thrashes around for 2 hours because, you know, he believes in manual control and he can't see any easy manual solutions.
Yeah, he just didn't seem anywhere near on top of his game.
Speaking about manual control, when I was listening to him, I tried to somehow forget anything, my preconceptions about Belarus, everything I know about Belarus, and tried to look at this with fresh eyes. And if I were listening to a head of state I don't know at all about, two things that came to mind. First, that this head of state wants to control a wide range of things, like some things that will be controlled not only in free market economies, but also in many, you know, state-run economies would not be controlled by the president himself, like starting from agriculture to municipal housing to everything. And he was trying. But secondly, he was sending two sets of messages on every issue. And as a foreign PR, it can be quite effective, as we have seen by the headlines in the Russian media and Ukrainian media. But as a means of communication which would result in some decisions, it sounded really strange. Like he was saying to the ministers that, you guys, you shouldn't sit in the cabinets if you want to know what's going on in the enterprises, in the plants and factories. You should go there and control and tell them what to do. But you shouldn't also, you shouldn't tell them what to do. Like, you shouldn't patronize every director. The directors know what to do. You shouldn't put into the details, but you shouldn't, like...
So the bureaucracy has got to be very confused after this speech, because people look for signals in speeches like this, and those signals were very, very...
So basically, in any case, he can say that the bureaucracy is not following his orders.
Right. All right, well, on that note, we'll shift gears to the second half. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and look at how Lukashenko's international maneuverings are affecting Belarus's domestic politics, with elections approaching in November. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is Alexei Znatkevich of RFRL's Belarus service. And joining us on the Skype line from Kyiv is Andrew Wilson, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and author of Belarus, The Last Dictatorship, and the recently published Ukraine Crisis, What It Means for the West. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Thank God the fate of our country is not being decided on front lines or on squares. Our future is being determined in quite a different and peaceful sphere, in the field of economy.
That, of course, was Alexander Lukashenko speaking to Parliament yesterday, the quote you actually referenced in the first half, Alexei, about how there will be no Maidan. In Belarus, our fate is not decided on squares. Maidan is, of course, the Ukrainian word for square. Funny thing is, opposition leader Alexander Milinkevich recently said something very similar, that we can't have a Maidan in Belarus because it would be too destabilizing given the situation right now. Whatever the foreign policy implications of Lukashenko's maneuverings and machinations in the aftermath of the Ukraine crisis, the domestic effect of both is clear. With election scheduled for November, the opposition is visibly subdued and visibly docile. Alexei, I know you keep a close eye on the Belarusian opposition. What do you see now going forward here? I mean, there seems to not even be the nominal challenge to him this time around.
Well, there are nominal challenges, but the people who participate know that they have no chances to win. And the problem, in addition to the fact that we have this example of the year 2010, when 9 out of 10 presidential candidates were suppressed, and 7 of them were in prison the same day, and one of them is still in prison to this day. In addition to that, we have an example of Ukraine. And in addition to explaining to voters and to even to activists how we take the power, because everybody understood in the year 2010 that it's impossible to take power from Lukashenko by elections only. There needs to be some kind of public pressure and some kind of...
A Maidan.
And at that time, yes, there was the words Ploshcha, which is square in Belarusian. So Ploshcha was seen as a viable alternative. But in addition to the fact that it's very difficult to organize anything like that in the current situation, the leaders of the opposition also need to answer this question: what do we do if we somehow, by miracle, happen to win, and the next day there'll be Russian troops or some kind of Russian-orchestrated coup? Are we really strong enough to preserve independence in this case? And I think the answer is, for many, is no.
That's interesting, because so the opposition has come to the conclusion that Belarusian independence is more important than getting rid of Lukashenko.
At least that's, I think, what Milinkevich has been saying for the last
No, and so this is a theme that comes up again and again. I mean, I remember years and years ago, I interviewed Milinkevich, and he said this debate is always going on in the opposition about what is more important, getting rid of Lukashenko or preserving
independence. Yeah, it's a long debate, but it has become very, very, you know, realistic because of the Ukraine, because now it's not a theoretical debate. It's very practical. Yeah. Everybody has seen what has happened in Donbass and Crimea.
Andrew, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's less to say on this subject because the election is likely to be a non-event unless there is some accidental or provoked disturbance. I mean, the opposition is weak anyway. And as you say, it's subdued, docile. I mean, that's both because they don't want to destabilize the situation in general, seeing what's happening in Ukraine, but also because they don't want to give Russia the excuse to intervene, you know, if there's a disorder in Minsk. The other aspect is the West, which is likely to give Lukashenko a free pass because of the geopolitical situation.
Right.
Unless he does something egregious or stupid, which seems unlikely. So it will be doubly quiet, we assume, unless other third parties have an interest in making it a little bit
precisely
noisier.
And follow up on that point, please, because I've often wondered, and again, Alexei and I were talking about this off mic yesterday. I want to hear your thoughts on this, Andrew, because I've often wondered if, you know, I always thought it'd be a brilliant move for Moscow to basically engineer a Maidan in Belarus, make it look like a democratic revolution. You know, it's kind of like a hybrid Maidan, whatever you want to call it, and install a pro-Moscow leader who's going to be less troublesome than Lukashenko. Do you think if there's a challenge to Lukashenko, it could possibly come from a stealthy Moscow-backed candidate?
Well, it wouldn't pan out like that, you know, because the Maidan took, 94 days, you know. Mm-hmm. If Lukashenko waited for 94 minutes, that would be surprising. You know, you're not talking about a long-term camp option or anything like that. I mean, there are all sorts of rumors about what happened in 2010, you know, who was behind the protest back then. I don't see it as a scenario that suits Russia at the moment unless it thinks Lukashenko is really not playing the game in foreign policy terms the way that it wants to. You have a few crazy voices in Russia, which is always important to listen to, because, you know, the crazy guys, you know.
Yesterday's crazies tend to be tomorrow's mainstreams in Russia.
Yeah, so. Well, they're licensed to be crazy or whatever. You know, so you have some people saying that Lukashenko has joined the ranks of Russia's enemies, blah, 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 blah. But I think that's a trial balloon. I don't think that's kind of mainstream Kremlin thought yet. So I don't think it's a likely option.
Mm.
But I guess it's one that Lukashenko's keeping his eye on, hence the law, Little Green Men law that you mentioned.
Alexei, I know you're skeptical of this option too. What do you think?
Well, in the year 2010, some of the opposition leaders were saying that Russia was behind the attempt to storm the government house, mm-hmm. and they were saying that it was Russia's idea and they wanted to destabilize the situation in Belarus. But I think the reason why there won't be any kind of pro-Russian Maidan is not only because...
pro-Russian stealthy candidate to challenge Lukashenko that does very well, is very well financed and wins, makes it close enough to...
Well, you see, one of the reasons is, of course, Lukashenko is much more repressive than the government in the Ukraine, and people in the square would be in prison, but also some of the candidates, mm-hmm. even pro-Russian candidates, should know...
He would go to that.
They need guarantees, and I mean, they know that if... There were candidates that were trying to have some guarantees from Moscow, but they've ended in prisons. Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't get telephone calls from Putin, but I don't know. But the reason there won't be pro-Russian Maidan also is I don't think Russia wants to change Lukashenko as long as he follows the basic rules. Mm-hmm. And it's better the devil you know. And if we remember what was happening in Ukraine a year ago, what kind of demands were there? I mean, Lukashenko is not trying even join the European Union. No. He's not trying to, you know, sign anything special in the Eastern Partnership summits. He's not, despite of all his pro-Western and anti-Russian statements that he can pepper sometimes. He has not changed. So as long as he keeps to the rules, they probably will keep him, because it will be a risk to try to instigate something, and I don't see the reason why they should do that.
Yeah, this is always the reason. I mean, and you're right. He's on a leash. He's trying to stretch that leash as long as he can, but he's not really stepped out of bounds as far as Moscow's true interests are.
I'd say more yet. Of a cage,
not
a leash.
But my assumption has always been that the reason Russia... I always thought that Russia would love to get rid of him if they could have somebody completely obedient in his place. But they would never do it because they're not confident they could control the transition.
It's more like a Russian proverb. It's better to be healthy and rich than to be poor and unhealthy and ill. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, in an ideal world, if they could, you know, make a computer model and put, I don't know, Rogozin in Minsk, make him Belarusian president, they would do it, of course. But in the real world, it's fraught with risks. Right.
Now let's switch back to the opposition. If we talked about how they've kind of made, because I am fascinated with this, that they've basically made this calculation that preserving Belarusian independence is more important than overthrowing Lukashenko, which essentially puts them on the same side as Lukashenko. If you're the Belarusian opposition, what are you thinking long term, and what are your prospects long term?
I also think it's a case of sour grapes. I mean, they on the one hand they say yes, we give priority to Belarusian independence, but on the other hand it's a very respectable thing. But on the other hand, they simply do not have the forces to overthrow Lukashenko.
No, they don't. But even if they did, as you pointed out quite correctly, Alexei, even if they did have the forces to overthrow Lukashenko, if they did, they'd suddenly be facing the Russian army, or at least the Little Green Men. They would. I think we can all agree on that. So even if they could overthrow him, even if they were a strong opposition, even if this were Ukraine's civil society with all its resourcefulness, it'd be suicide. Essentially, to do this. So what do you do in this situation if you're the Belarusian opposition? I know you follow them very closely.
You try to survive, to keep the structures, and, you know, changes sometimes happen despite or irrespective of what the politicians are doing. Mm. I mean, there can be circumstances that happen and... they are not necessarily caused by the actions of specific politicians. Mm. So it's important to at least have some forces and to have some structures at certain time when things change despite or irrespective of what you do.
Right. Andrew?
The only thing I'd add is, you know, what the long-term consequences of this are. I mean, we should speak the right language. The difference is so vast compared to Ukraine. The opposition is disorganized, irrelevant often, and possibly now more so, you know, by opting out really of the kind of real politics of this election. You know, what are they for in the longer term? So by being patriotic, they may become less relevant.
And if you're a Belarusian opposition activist, your goal right now is what? As Alexei says, just survive and hope for the best, keep the structures and... That's it.
Well, yeah. Why come next year follow these leaders at all? You know, what leadership are they providing? You know, what are we supposed to be doing? We've given up on democratization. We've given up on real politics as well. You know, there's not much left.
Pretty bleak picture.
Well, I mean, the leader of the United Civic Party, Anatoly Lebedka, he's been in an opposition for so long. He's running as a president, as a presidential candidate. And I'm pretty sure he will be criticizing the government. He will be saying the right words about the need for economic changes. So he will be, like, publicizing this platform. The only thing is he will be pretty sure he has no chances to win.
All right. There's just a couple other points I wanted to touch on before we wrapped up. And one, I meant to mention this in the first half, didn't get around to it. Lukashenko purged the bureaucracy of so-called pro-Russian elements, or at least some of them. Again, you're skeptical, Alexei. I love it when you're skeptical. Give me your skepticism.
Yeah, I'm silently skeptical as well.
Yeah.
Well, there were some well-publicized cases, and of course, Lukashenko. There were several well-publicized cases when there were really like pro-Russian marginal figures in the state administration on a low level.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, a guy in Vitebsk region, he was in the executive committee, and at the same time, he was publicizing the idea, you know, this Western Russianism, you know, mm-hmm. the idea that there's no Belarusian nation, no Which, Ukrainian nation, there's only one Russian nation, big Russian, like which includes Russians, Ukrainians, and Belarusians. So he was fired, yes. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you can purge something when it's part of the official ideology for so long. You know, right. So
this is a meaningless gesture?
It's a couple of freaks here. I mean, it's an important gesture in a certain sense, but it has its limits.
Mm. Andrew?
Yeah, one problem here is that we don't really know enough about the Belarusian Siloviki, you know, what happens within their very, very black box. I mean, the KGB is one. How much it's been de-Russified under Lukashenko or his son. The fact that we keep hearing stories to that effect makes me rather doubt that it's been completely purged of pro-Russian elements. But much more clearly, the armed forces, because they have this, you know, they've had 15, 20 years of cooperation with Russia, information sharing. Some of these guys are trained on Russian soil, mm-hmm. You know, as part of those kind of joint operations. There have been problems with them recently with information sharing or whatever. But that in the armed forces, that goes very, very, very deep indeed. Mm. So I'm pretty skeptical of the idea that the bureaucracy has been cleansed.
Yeah.
Speaking of symbols, you know, I think there'll be much spoken about Lukashenko's not coming to the parade in Moscow on May 9th. So somebody will try to picture it as part of, you know, also pro-Western stance.
But he never goes.
But the fact is, he'll have his own parade as usual in Minsk, and a large part of the troops there will be Russian troops.
Mm, that's an interesting point. Last thing before we go from both of you, does he go to Riga? Does it matter? What do you think?
No, he doesn't, because this is the red line, because when he goes to Georgia, it's, you know, my colleague Yuri Drakakhrust in our service, he made this comparison. When people from Georgia and people from Belarus, for example, try to make some anti-Russian statement, a mildly anti-Russian statement, it's still like children of, you know, post-Soviet family arguing with a parent. But when they run to NATO or to the European Union, this is betrayal of loyalty. And when Russia made this statement that the summit in Riga is an anti-Russian event, as soon as they made the statement, it says no for Lukashenko.
So
he won't go.
Andrew, do you agree?
I agree that it's very unlikely. That's one reason. The second reason is that there are kind of prestige risks for Lukashenko. Colleague of mine once compared him to a Serbian army officer. He's always on the lookout for slights and insults. You know, so there's a question of, you know, how long his red carpet would be. It couldn't possibly be long enough in Riga, I don't think.
If he goes, is that significant?
I don't think he will because of the signals from Russia and because of his own calculation.
If he did, yes.
It would be significant.
Yeah, if he did. Sure. Because it would be unexpected, yeah.
Because there's been rumors that he might get an invitation. They've basically issued the invitation to Belarus, leaving it open who will represent Belarus. But there's been rumors that this might happen.
We can make a bet.
I'm not going to bet. I don't know what I think. I'm asking you guys.
I say no.
Okay. We'll keep our eyes open for that. And that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio has Ben Alexei Znatkevich of RFERL's Belarus service. And joining us on the Skype line from Kyiv has been Andrew Wilson, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and author of Belarus, The Last European Dictatorship, and of the recently published Ukraine Crisis, What It Means for the West. Thank you both for an interesting and enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast, as well as all other Power Vertical products, will take a 2-week hiatus to give me a chance to catch my breath. But after that, we'll be back bigger and better, and we'll even have a few surprises for you. So keep an eye on our Facebook page for the details. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.